Session number 13444, reel number 1.
Mr. Bilton, reel 1. Were you born in Hull?
Well, outside of Hull, it's Annalaby.
Which year were you born?
1923, October.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a coach builder for, well, it's now British Railway, but for, first of all, Hull and Barnsley, and then it was taken over by the London North Eastern, and he built the coaches and the wagons. He was with them all his life.
Did you go to school in Annalaby?
Annalaby Church of England School. And then the last 2 years I was at Heslam School when they closed the Church of England one down. I left school 1938.
So you were 14?
14, yes.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I went and got a job as an apprentice furniture salesman.
In Hull?
In Hull, at Harry Jacobs Furnishers.
Were you doing that when war broke out?
I was still with them when war broke out. I was with them until I went into the forces in 1942.
What was your reaction when you heard Chamberlain make the declaration that we were at war with Germany?
Well, I think I was a bit too young and didn't know anything about it. But I volunteered for an ARP messenger boy, and I was accepted. And that kept us busy on the night time, even with practices.
Where did you volunteer for it?
Annalaby House, which became the central headquarters for the ARP in Halton Price. It is now the headquarters of Beverley Borough Council, the same house.
What kind of work did you have to do as an ARP messenger boy?
Well, if any of the telephone lines were broken in a raid, we had to go out and take messages from one post to another.
By foot?
No, on our bikes.
Did you have a uniform?
No, just a steel helmet and an extra special gas mask, that's all.
What was so extra special then?
Well, it was more like the services one, not like the ordinary civilian gas mask.
What was the difference between the two?
Well, it was heavier and, well, just, and you didn't have the mask at the face, you had a small canister at the side.
So you didn't have the protuberance?
No, that's right.
Did you have an armband to show who you were?
Yes, ARP messenger. That was all. And your steel helmet with M on.
What did M mean? For messenger?
For messenger.
Did you get paid for it?
No, it was all voluntary. No, nothing at all. You, when the sirens went, you reported to Annalaby House and you stayed there until all clear, then you went back home.
Whereabouts did you do this work?
In Annalaby. The farthest we ever had to bring a message was from Annalaby to Cottingham when the lines were down.
Did you enjoy doing it?
Oh yes, I did.
Could you have thrown it up any time you liked?
Any time you wanted, you could decide to finish and that was it.
Was there competition to get these jobs?
Well, there was about four of us and that's all they needed. They all went in the forces, and of the four, there was one killed.
How did that happen?
It was a lad called John Harding. He was killed in Italy about a month after the war. He went all through the desert, all through Italy, and he was killed about a month after the war, moving shells from the artillery.
Were there any incidents that happened to you when you were doing the messenger work that
Not
you
really.
Can recount?
No, it was very, very quiet in the area of Halton Price. All the damage that was done in Hull. I think we had, five bombs dropped in the village of Annalaby and they were unexploded.
Whereabouts did they drop?
At the, about 200 or 300 yards from Annalaby House down Woodlands Drive in a snicket.
A snicket being a cut-through?
A cut-through, yes. They did no damage. The army came, found them, and exploded them.
Was anybody injured?
No, there was no injuries whatsoever.
When did the bombs drop on Annaby? Which year would that have been?
That was in the big raid of 1940. May the 8th, 1941.
Any others that you remember that dropped in Annaby?
None at all. It was only the five.
Did you ever see the damage in Hull?
Yes, I used to work in Hull. The place where I was employed in Jameson Street was completely gutted during the 1941 raid.
What was the name again?
Harry Jacobs Furnitures, Jameson Street.
What else did you see of the damage in Hull?
All of Jameson Street. We moved, our offices were down Osborne Street, and that was severely damaged. You could say all of Paragon Square, which was Hammond's at the time, was gutted. There was a terrific amount of damage done, and especially in the Stone Ferry district, where the oil mills were and the flour mills, Baranxes.
Did people come out from Hull to Annaby to get away from the bombing?
Yes, they did. They built a camp down the Lowfield Road in Annaby for displaced personnel from the raids. And there was one built on Priory Road, just outside Cottingham, which was taken up by people who'd been bombed out. Those two camps after the war housed the young couples who got married with, and they had no housing. When I got married in 51, I finished up in one of those converted accommodations for a year before I got a house.
What were they like?
Valerie?
Just describe them.
Well, they were just two bedroom. You had a small bedroom, small living room, and there was a small like kitchen for you're cooking and you're doing your washing. Well, in Priory Road, the camp, yes. We spent a year in there, didn't we? Before we came to Cottingham. There was no housing at all. And they were in use for about 10 years before they were finally closed down.
What was the standard of accommodation there?
Poor. The single bricks, very damp. Corrugated roof.
Was it later used to house Poles?
That's correct. Yes.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be in the Air Force?
I volunteered for aircrew when I was 18. I went before the selection board and I was accepted as a wireless operator air gunner.
Which year would this have been?
That was in 1941. I was 18 in October 41 and I volunteered then and went down for an interview at Padgate. I went through the examinations, then my medical, and then the aircrew selection board, and I was accepted for training as a WAFA AG.
Why did you volunteer for it?
I should have made a very, very poor sailor, and my father always says, don't go into the army. He'd had enough.
So you wanted to exercise the choice before you were directed?
Before I was directed.
But you were... Did you become a WAP air gunner?
No. They had a terrific influx of people wanting to be WAP AGs. And I think I'd been waiting about 4 months to go in, and they were short of flight engineers for training. So they asked me if I would like to take a trade trust board and become a flight engineer for training, and I accepted that. They said, "We're waiting." So I was called up in August 42, went to Blackpool, did my initial training, foot slogging, and I stayed in Blackpool then for about 10 months doing a flight mechanic and a fitters course. Passed out AC1 flight mechanic and AC1 fitter, and I went down to St Athens for 6 weeks to do the Halifax course, and I graduated then in August 43, and I was posted from St Athens up to number 6 group, a heavy conversion unit, 1664, which was then at Croft, and I crewed up with a Canadian and English mixed crew on August 1943.
In that training, did you run into any problems? With
none at all. The only time I got jankers was for failing to carry a bin whilst on duty. And I got 7 days CB for it, and I swore never again to do any punishment.
What happened to you on the CB?
CB, where you reported at 6 o'clock after you'd done all your schoolwork for 3 hours of square bashing. 55 minutes square bashing, 5 minutes off with full kit. Saturday, you scrub the naffy out at Squire's Gate, and it was a huge one. Sunday, you reported after church parade, on the hour, every hour, until 10 o'clock at night. That was enough, no more. So I kept my shoes clean after that.
Did you resent the punishment?
Not really. It taught you to behave yourself.
What did you think of the quality of training that you got?
Very good. The instructors were very good. Had no complaints whatsoever against any of the instructors. They were always fair, and they helped you whenever, all the way through the course.
Were you taught what you had to know, or did they miss?
Well, I think the original entries of flight engineers were given far too much training on engines. You didn't have to become a fitter to become a flight engineer. As they found out later, they shortened the course to about a 12-week course, where it took me nearly a year. You didn't have to be a qualified flight fitter engine to become a flight engineer.
What did a flight engineer have to do in the bomber?
Look after chiefly the control of the engines, the petrol consumption, know the hydraulic systems and all the emergencies. Assisting takeoff and landing.
If the pilot had been hit, would you have been able to pilot it?
It would have been a struggle. As a Halifax flight engineer, you didn't have any pilot training. You were never on the controls, whereas in a Lancaster, you were. You acted as the second pilot for takeoff and landing. But on a Halifax bomber, the bomb aimer assisted in takeoff and landing.
Now, you said that you were posted to 6 Group. Can you tell me about what 6 Group was?
6 Group was the Halifax Group, financed by the Royal Canadian Government. They provided all the aircraft, and the crews were mixed. I had 3 English and 4 Canadians in the crew. The pilot was pilot, navigator, and the 2 gunners, Canadians, the wireless operator, the bomb aimer, and myself were the English members of the crew.
How was the crew formed?
Well, I met the crew. They'd done their operational training unit course, and they were posted up to Croft, and 10 crews and 10 flight engineers were told, sort yourself out, and they picked me. And I accepted them, and I went with them. You weren't told you'll fly with that man or you'll fly with them. You were left to individually sort yourself out which crew you wanted to go with. So if you'd met a sergeant in the mess, you knew him and got to have a drink or two before you were crewed up, you went to him.
How did you like serving with Canadians?
Oh, they were very good. Very friendly. They didn't have the bull. The discipline wasn't as severe on the Canadian group as it was on the English group.
Can you give an example?
Well, I mean, you mix freely with the... When I was an NCO, you mixed freely with the two officers, Canadian officers. No trouble at all in calling you by your Christian names.
was your first operational squadron?
My first operational squadron, well, I lost my first pilot. We went to 427 squadron, and Sergeant Dresser went on his second dicky trip and never came back.
But 427 was your first?
The first squadron at Leeming. So we were a crew without a captain.
When did you join that squadron, do you think?
We joined 427 squadron 4th of September, and we left on the 23rd of September. We were posted back to 1659 conversion unit Topcliff, where there was another pilot waiting for us.
So did you do any operations?
None at all. No, none whatsoever there. As I say, the pilot never came back from his second dicky to Frankfurt.
So you were posted to a new squadron?
A new conversion unit for a new pilot. A new pilot by the name of Watkins, a flying officer. He'd been instructing in Canada for nearly 2 years. He'd been come over, and we crewed up with him on the 24th of September. The flying officer Watkins at 1659 conversion unit Topcliff. And we went through our month training with him again to the 7th of October 43, where we were posted to 428 Squadron Middleton St George.
And it was then that you started operations?
Operations, yes. The first operation we did was the 3rd of November.
Can you describe what you remember of it?
Very, very little. It was Dusseldorf, and everything seemed to be on top of you at the first. You know, you didn't take it all in. All I seem to remember is a little bit of flak and the flares going down for target indicators for bombing. Everything happened so fast on your first two or three trips that you hadn't adjusted to operation flying and being shot at. I learnt more on my second off. We went to Ludwigshafen on the 18th of November.
What happened then?
Well, we got coned over the target. We got the master's searchlight on us, which is a bluey colour, and he followed us, and we got out of him after a lot of evasive action. And as soon as we got out, a fighter opened up on us, and we got a good hiding. The rear gunner was severely wounded. The IFF that we had was damaged. Monica, which we had, was damaged. All the trimming wires for elevator and rudders were cut. We had petrol tank wires cut for 1, 2, and 4 tanks. All hydraulic pipes were cut. We couldn't close the bomb doors, they were fully open. We were in a mess, and we got hit about 21,000 feet, and by the time the pilot got control, we were down to 15,000. We had no navigational aids, and the navigator brought us back by straight navigation on the Polestar. We were off track coming back, and we crossed over Ostend at 15,000 feet, and they hit us with everything.
The what?
Hit us with everything. They opened up with everything they had, and we couldn't take any evasive action. We just had to go through it.
This was the flak?
Yeah. It was flaming onions coming up in between the tailplane and the mainplane. It was rough. And then we crossed the coast, and we still didn't know exactly where we were. So the skipper called up. The emergency call sign then was Darkie and Woodbridge accepted the call, and we did a full emergency landing there.
What was the emergency landing like?
It was very rough. We couldn't get the undercarriage came down, but I couldn't lock it down. And we tried everything, going into a shallow dive, pulling out to see if we could just jerk it that 2 or 3 inches to make it lock. And we couldn't do that. And we were all in emergency positions. Coming into land, and just as he pulled up to do a belly landing, it just threw that little bit forward, the wheels, and the locked. So we were all right. We came out. The rear gunner, we'd patched him up, we'd pumped him morphine into him, and he went to Norwich Hospital. We never saw him again. He was very badly wounded in the head. And we spent the night there, and then an aircraft flew us back the next morning to our base at Middleton St George.
What was the date of that?
18th of November.
And which Halifax was it? What was it called?
N-A-O-O-B-O. We took off for the night's operation at 16:45, and the trip lasted 7 hours and 5 minutes.
Did that put you off wanting to go on operations after that experience?
Not really. We were in operations again on the 26th of November. We took 2 spare gunners and we went to Stuttgart. And we had a reasonable trip. We had no fighter trouble, but when we went there, was a diversionary raid being done on Frankfurt, and the Germans had laid what they call the fighter flares path, what the Mosquitoes were taking. Oh, and it looked rough. We bypassed it, and Stuttgart was quite a normal trip, bit of flak, no fighters, and I think that brought the confidence of the crew back.
When you went on these trips to Stuttgart and Ludwigshafen, could you see other planes being hit?
Not on those two, no. I never saw anyone shot down over Ludwigshafen, Stuttgart, or the first trip, Dusseldorf.
How did your next operations go?
Well, the next operations was January 20th, 44, Berlin. And that was a rough one.
Can you describe it?
Well, at one part, the Germans had laid a flare path of fighter flares, and they were in amongst the bomber stream, and they were going down. You could see the fire from the German aircraft, and a small amount coming from the Allied aircraft. And then you'd just see a ball of fire, and it would hold steady for a minute or two, then it would just go into a dive. That was quite an experience to see it. And we got to Berlin, was in the first wave, and the target indicators were a few seconds late, and we got caught in predicted flak, because we're in the first wave. We had no cover from the metal strips, the tinfoil that we threw out. It didn't affect you, didn't help you, it helped the people behind you. And it was a bit hot.
Which was the worst, this Berlin one or the Ludwigshafen?
Ludwigshafen was the worst. I mean, we got a lot of shot, a lot of holes, a lot of damage. This Berlin, it was just that you were in a predicted flak. We didn't get hit, we didn't have any fighter trouble. Berlin, Ludwigshafen, I'll never forget it. Never.
Was Berlin a particularly dreaded place to
it
go
was.
To?
It was. Yes, it was such a long stooge. It took us 8 hours 15 minutes. It was very tiring, and it was overpowering on the target area because it was so heavily defended. There were so many searchlights. I think on the first one, we lost about 40-odd aircraft that night.
You said which particular Halifax you had. Did you always have the same one?
No. That was Halifax NA U-Uncle on that Berlin trip.
Was there any competition to get the best aircraft?
No, it was just what you were allocated. Our pilot later became a flight commander, and he took any aircraft. I mean, I think we're nearly always in a B flight that we flew aircraft.
What does that mean?
We had A flights and B flights.
As part of the squadron, to make up the squadron.
To mark up the squadron, yes. And the A flights were the first half of the alphabet, and so the second B was the second half. It was either V Victor, Q Queenie, or O Hobo later on that we flew in.
But was there ever any feeling that the more senior people were getting the best aircraft?
No. No.
Or the best ground crews?
No. The best ground crews were on operational squadrons. I thought so, anyhow.
But was there any difference between the different ground crews that you had in your squadron?
No. They were all first class. They all did a first class job. The aircraft were always in good condition. We never turned back from 34 trips for any trouble whatsoever.
What was the next operations that you had to do?
Well, the next two I did were two mine laying stooges. One was to Kiel, which was a quiet trip, and the other one was down to La Rochelle, which is a very long stooge, 8 hours 10 minutes. And that was 4th of February, 44. Then we went to Berlin again on the 15th of February.
Was mine laying usually a quiet job?
Yes, but it was a very hard job, because you were by yourself. There'd probably be about 20 aircraft, you know, to lay mines, and you were on your own. You had no cover whatsoever. I mean, the tinfoil that you threw out didn't help you. It more or less showed you the Germans where you were, because you were always ahead of the tinfoil you were throwing out. There'd be about 20, probably 22, 23 aircraft would go down to La Rochelle and lay two mines apiece in between the island of La Rochelle and the mainland.
Did you ever call those gardening operations?
They are gardening operations. I did the La Rochelle. I did two La Rochelles in February, one on the 4th and one on the 21st, and then on the 25th I did a mine laying stooge to Copenhagen Sound.
Well, what was your next Berlin operation like? Was it any different from the first?
Same as the first. A lot of flak, a lot of fighter activity, but we never had an attack. And that day night we were diverted to Chipdam, which was an American base, and was there for 3 days for bad weather. Our base was closed down and we stayed with the Americans at their hospitality.
What was the date of your second Berlin raid?
15th of February. We took off in NA Q Queenie. We took off at 17:20. Was airborne for 6 hours 50 minutes.
What did you fear most over Berlin? Was it the night fighters or the
flak? Night fighters. The flak, no. It was the fighters. We were always looking out for fighters. You didn't want to battle with them. You wanted to get out of the way, because the armament that we had was 4 303s, were just like pea shooters to their cannons. So if you could see them and get out of the way, that was the main thing.
And then after Berlin, that second Berlin operation?
After Berlin we did, as I say, two mine laying stooges, the La Rochelle and Copenhagen Sound in February. Then March we started off with another gardening operation, mine laying, to the mouth of the Gironde River, which was 7 hours 50 minutes. Then we started the pre-D-Day marshalling yards in March of 44.